My grandfather was Abraham Zapruder. He had come to America in 1920 from Russia, a Jewish immigrant like so many millions before him, and had settled in New York. And then in the early 1940s, he and my grandmother moved to Dallas for a business in the for a business opportunity in the garment industry. He was a dressmaker. So he had a manufacturing company called Jennifer Juniors, which was at 501 Elm Street, right in downtown Dallas, just near Dealey Plaza. And that's why he was able to just walk across the street basically and go position himself to film the president. And I should add that, you know, he was there because he loved the president, and he was there because he was a very avid home movie maker and had been making home movies since 1934. So all of those things combined to put him in that particular place at that particular time.
But he almost forgot the camera that morning, right?
Yes, he actually decided not to take it. It's often been said that he forgot it, but I think it's really more accurate to say that he decided not to take it and then was sort of persuaded to go back for it by his assistant Lillian Rogers, who was a dear friend. And he was somebody who was, you know, somewhat insecure in a way. He had had a very difficult childhood in Russia, very poor. He didn't have an education. He had seen a lot of traumatic things, and he was somebody who didn't really like to put himself forward in a certain kind of way. And so, you know, it was in a way, it's kind of understandable that he, you know, he didn't like to take risks. And I think that's why he left the camera at home. He just sort of decided against it. And then it was Lillian who said, you know, you really should go home and do this. This will mean so much to you to have it. And he always listened to Lillian, luckily for us and luckily for history.
Okay, and then when the Kennedy limousine passed by, what did your grandfather see through his viewfinder?
It was a Bell and Howell kind of top of the line new camera. It had a zoom lens and was a very high quality camera. And what he saw first is the president and the first lady in the motorcade coming around the corner and coming down Elm Street, and the first few seconds are just perfect. And then the president and first lady disappear behind a street sign, the Stemmons street sign. And then when the president comes out the other side, you can see that something is wrong. His arms are up around his throat, and he's been hit. And then a few seconds later comes this terrible shot to the head, and he witnessed, you know, this murder of the president in real time at close range, and it was a moment that I think stayed with him for the rest of his life. He was witnessing it at very close range, and I think he saw, you know, he saw it in all of its horrific detail, perhaps even more than what is reflected on the film.
You could tell that he was traumatized every time he even thought about what he was witnessing through the viewfinder.
I think that's right. And I think part of it is the violence of it, but part of it is also just the painful association with something so tragic and so sad. And also for him, I always think about the fact that he was a Russian immigrant and he had come to this country because he believed in America and because he believed in its promise and he believed in a democratic and free society. And then, you know, he witnessed this moment that seemed more like something that would happen in Russia than something that would happen here. And I think that, you know, sense of something betrayed about America and what he believed that this country was all about was deeply, deeply painful to him.
Right after the film was shot, what did your grandfather want to do with it? How did the rest of us get to know what was on that film?
It's a very long story. That day itself was a long story. He was distraught. He was crying. He was screaming hysterically on Dealey Plaza that the president had been killed. And he was approached by Harry McCormick, who was a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, who wanted to know if, you know, what he had on his camera. And he said right in that moment, and continued to say for the whole day, that he wanted to get it in the hands of the federal authorities first and foremost. And so the rest of the day was spent, part of it with Forrest Sorrells, the head of the Secret Service in Dallas, and with Harry McCormick, going from place to place, trying to find first to WFAA in Dallas, and then to out to the Kodak Labs near Love Field to have the film processed. And then there was another step of getting the film duplicated and then processed again, and then brought to the Secret Service late that night. But even though it was in the hands of the federal government that very evening, it was another 12 years before the American people saw it as a moving picture film on national television. So it was really a sign of the times that, you know, this was something that could be kept kept away from the American people for that length of time.
So it was 12 years before people saw the 26 seconds in their entirety?
Yes, that's exactly right. The film, still, my grandfather sold the film to Life magazine the day after the assassination, and stills from the film were published in the magazine. And bootlegs began to circulate within the next few years. But Life magazine had made an agreement with my grandfather that, you know, they would treat this film with dignity, that they would be respectful of the Kennedy family, that they wouldn't exploit it or sensationalize it in any way, which was terribly important to my grandfather. And they honored that request. But part of what that meant was that they couldn't show it as a film because, first of all, they didn't have a television affiliate. There was no way for them to do it, you know, from that point of view. But also, as I've often thought, there's really no way to show the Zapruder film tastefully. That's a contradiction in terms, you know. So they were in a tough situation. And finally, it was in 1975 that Geraldo Rivera got a bootleg copy of the film from Robert Groden, who was an avid member of the assassination and remains an avid member of the assassination conspiracy community, and aired it on national television on Goodnight America was the name of his show.
Can you imagine if, God forbid, it happened today with social media and everybody shooting digital? Have you ever reflected on that?
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways, the film represents the first thing of its kind, the first example of citizen journalism, and something that, you know, launched what we now, you know, consider to be so ubiquitous, what now is so ubiquitous, these, you know, cell phone camera videos of absolutely everything that occurs. And I, in a way, what I tried to do in the book was trace that arc of the film, which is the first thing of its kind and that broke so many boundaries and so many barriers. And now we're in a time where everything is recorded and everything is on YouTube instantly. But the deep questions that plagued the film are still the questions that we have to ask ourselves today about, you know, who records history? How do we decide what the American people should see or shouldn't see? What is the effect of sharing certain things and so widely? How does it change our society? These are all the kinds of questions that, you know, that dogged the film in the early years and throughout the decades, and that I think we still ask ourselves now.
Does the original film still exist?
The original film exists. It resides in the National Archives. It is the property of the American people now. And the copyright to the film, we donated the copyright to the film to the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, Texas. So as far as licensing it and being able to decide who uses it, that is now in the hands of this terrific museum in Dallas.